Larry Steibel is going to talk about mastering the new rules of the game, job interviews. Larry has a perspective about career management that comes from recruiting senior executives as well as helping them advance their careers. He is president and co-founder of Steibel Peabody Lincolnshire and Arbora Global Company. The company's mission is to help client companies achieve smooth leadership change when the stakes are high. Core services revolve around retained search, executive level career consultation, and helping high potential leaders succeed by changing how they think and act. FBI and Larry and Steibel Peabody have a special relationship. He's been a frequent speaker at FBI national conventions. He and Kevin Rhodes were co-leaders of an FBI roundtable for CFOs of public companies. And he's been, as we say, a great friend at FBI. So without further ado, please join me in welcoming Larry Steibel.
Thanks very much. Can you all hear me? Some of you are in job search mode, and some of you are going to be interviewing candidates for jobs. And everybody in the room is going to have both roles. And what I hope to talk about is the job search game from both perspectives. As was said, I've spent 31 years working with senior executives in helping them with their careers. I've spent about 7 years recruiting for board members, CEOs, and CFOs. That makes me an outstanding person to be addressing this group, and it makes me totally useless to do anything else. I want to start off by talking about what are your leading indicators in the economy. Everybody's got some mental indicators to help them understand where the economy is going to be. I'm going to tell you about mine, and then maybe you could share me yours, and we could sort of just talk about where we see the economy going. One of my leading indicators for the economy is the Newton Marriott Hotel, right here. Al Faber and I can usually be found here for breakfast, and I actually count the tables. When the tables are filled, when I see the parking lot filled, I know that deals are being done because of the location of this place. When the parking lot's empty, and when there's no tables at 8 and 8:30, I know because no deals are being done. So that's one leading indicator that I have. I have a second leading indicator, and that's a company called Nipro. Anybody familiar with Nipro? Okay, it's the world's largest plastic extrusion company based in Clinton, Massachusetts. So I monitor Nipro. I'm looking to see what contracts that they're getting. I'm looking to see their expansion. Because name a product that isn't made of plastic. So when stuff gets done, Nipro is going to be involved in it. There's a third leading indicator that I have, and I hope I can get onto the internet. If not, I'll just talk you through it. Can I get here? Okay, I'm going to go here to Google. I'm going to go Yahoo Finance Profile Manpower. And I'm going over here. This is a company some of you may have heard of called Manpower. It's the world's largest temporary employment agency. It's based in Wisconsin. I'm going here to the basic chart. I'm scrolling down here. I'm going to look at the last 3 months, and then I'm going to compare Manpower with the S&P 500. The blue line is Manpower. The green line is the S&P 500. Can you all see that? So here's my theory. One of the changes in the game is that when the economy begins to improve, employers no longer have the option only of hiring full-time employees or W-2. They have lots of different options. They can hire 1099s in interim form. They can hire consultants. They can hire consulting firms. But Manpower is a good sort of surrogate for the 1099 market because it's the world's largest interim company. And interim employment is tremendously sensitive. So when the economy starts going down, who are you going to lay off first? Your interim people. When the economy starts going up, who are you going to hire first? Interim people. And I've been through these recessions 3 times, and they always go in the same place. People first get hired as interim, then they're tried out, and then they move to W-2. So 1099 to W-2. How many have gone through that in their careers? 1099 to W-2. Well, it's going to happen again. So what I'm seeing when I look at Manpower over the last 3 months is you can see that it's no longer tracking the S&P 500. It's significantly higher. To me, that tells me something. I'm not going to do this now, but if I were to go back 2 years to September 08, you will see that Manpower started crashing about 7 days before the stock market crashed. So Manpower is a very sensitive indicator. So how about yours? What are your leading indicators? What indicators do you have that might give you a sense about where the economy is going? You almost have something. I told you mine. What are yours? And what are your indicators telling you? Anybody?
Unemployment.
And where is that telling you?
Unemployment is going up.
As in
claims going up, it means something is not working. More people are hard.
I'm not sure that's true. When the economy starts getting better, people who've given up on looking for jobs start going into the marketplace, temporarily raising the unemployment rate. That's number one. Number two is because of the structural presence and the ease of getting 1099 employees involved, interim, consulting, project management, you're going to see that employment historically is a lagging indicator. It's even going to be much more a lagging indicator. It's not good for Obama in November, but I'm not sure that the employment rate is going to be necessarily predictive. It's a lagging indicator. I'm looking for leading indicators. We can't base our career decisions and our businesses on lagging indicators. Unemployment is the classic lagging indicator. And can anybody think of a leading indicator that they use? What do you use?
Relative level of consumer debt.
Relative level of consumer debt. And what's that telling you?
To the extent that it's going down, it means there's more buying capacity by consumers, and consumer buying is one of the drivers of the market.
Okay, so consumers those who are working have more money in their pockets so they can buy stuff. Again, another leading indicator came out in the Wall Street Journal today is the tonnage that's going on railroads. And that's increasing. So that's a positive sign. Anybody else?
Manufacturing
capacity?
If it's declining.
Yep.
If it's slowing, if it's picking up, if the capacity, if they're working at 90%, 95%.
Okay, so you see manufacturing capacity as a leading indicator. If it's going up, that's a good sign. And what are you seeing? Is it going up?
I think it has been going up.
It has been going up. Anybody else?
FedEx, UPS.
FedEx, UPS is a fabulous leading indicator. And what do you see about FedEx and UPS?
It's starting to increase.
Okay, so all of the leading indicators say cautiously optimistic for 2011. Are things going to be wow? Is it going to be spectacular? No. But is it going to be better than 2010? Yes. And will 2010 be better than 2009? Yes. So the signs are positive. I wrote a piece in Harvard Business Review about 2 years ago on leading indicators If any of you would like a copy of that, just give me your business cards or scribble something on a piece of paper and I'll be glad to send that to you. What we're going to be talking about are some of the structural changes that have occurred in employment interviews. And again, my perspective is a unique perspective because I've been on both sides of it, both as a recruiter as well as somebody who helps people with their job campaigns. We're going to be talking about how the interview game has changed over the last 25 years. We're going to be talking about what I call the arduous technique, phone screening interviews. I'm going to start at a very abstract, esoteric level and then get down to very basic, concrete suggestions that you can do if you are an interviewer or an interviewee. We will be talking about some of the sensitive questions that job candidates have, such as your salary is too high, you're too old, you have disabilities. And finally, we're going to be talking about something that I call the killer close. When I talked about the new rules of the job interview game, I don't necessarily mean that something happened in September 08 or 9/11. What I am talking about is that there has been a shift over the last 15, 20 years. And when we look back on it, we'll kind of look at signal events like September 08 to sort of mark the demarcation. But I just think the things that I'm talking about have been a gradual change. The first change that I have been seeing in my practice is the emphasis on risk management in job, in employment hiring. When many of us were much younger in the 70s and the early 80s, and there were companies that were growing at 20-25% a year, companies were very open about rapidly hiring and making mistakes when they were hiring. Because when you're growing at 20% a year, you can actually make a lot of hiring mistakes and you can bury a lot of hiring mistakes. When you're growing at 3%, 5%, 10%, you don't have that much ability to make those mistakes. And if you mishire, it's going to bite you. And so the hiring today is when I'm approached by companies, they say, we want to hire the best and brightest. And of course, when I'm in sales mode, I say, of course, I can get you the best and brightest. But when I actually look at who my clients are hiring, it's not the best and brightest. They're hiring the least risky choices. When it all comes down to it, it's not about who's the best. It's about who's the least risky. Employers are very concerned about their vulnerability and their risk. If I was going to give you a role model as a job candidate, I would suggest you watch The Dog Whisperer on cable television. How many of you have watched that? Cesar Millan? Basically, he's got it. Watch Cesar Millan. Cesar Millan has this calm assurance that everything's going to be okay. He doesn't panic. He just has this. And he presents it to dogs, but he presents it to the humans that he's dealing with on the show as well. And if you put Cesar Millan and gave him a white coat, he would be the archetype of what I'd want as a cancer surgeon who's going to be doing my cancer. Just calm, assured, no extravagances, just calm. And I think that's, if you're looking for a role model for how to conduct a job interview, watch Cesar Millan. Watch The Dog Whisperer. It's on Nature. It's in one of those Nature channels. The second change that I have seen is anybody here from higher education? Anybody from higher education? Oh, good. So we can talk. In general, higher education lags behind business. But there are exceptions. One of those exceptions is higher education really grasped the implications of the internet long before business caught on. A second thing is that higher education grasped the implications that job interviews basically don't have good predictive validity. Business is beginning to grasp it. People privately talk about it, but it hasn't been openly discussed in business. That job interviews basically do not have good predictive validity. When you're making a hiring decision, basically, you're making a bet, aren't you? You're betting that I'm going to hire Kevin, and that a year from now, I'm going to be glad I hired Kevin, because Kevin can do the job. And what am I basing it on? A resume, an hour chat, and some conversations with the people that Kevin suggested I call. And the statisticians call that predictive validity. And when they look at studies of job interviews and predictive validity, it's pretty pathetic. You basically would do just as well flipping a coin. There's actually been a classic study. You know, most of us in business, and when I've talked to business people, I'd say, what are you proud of? What are you most proud of? And they say, oh, my ability to size people up. I've got this great judgment, you know. I can spot bullshit a mile away. You know, I'm really good at that. Well, when they actually test it out, most of us are just about as good as statistically random chance. A wonderful study is that they took people whose lives depend on making good judgments. CIA operatives who are field agents, FBI operatives who are field agents, police, Secret Service, judges. And they asked them to look at a particular situation where somebody had seen a fabulous movie, and it really was a great movie. Like somebody saw Star Wars, and they loved Star Wars, and they were talking about it. Then, in another case, the same person saw an appendix operation, and they had to talk about what a great movie that they saw. And so in one case, they had to lie. In one case, they had to tell the truth. And the issue is, can these people whose job it is to spot lies tell a liar from the truth? And the answer is no. Their ability is about 50%. And the same thing is with job interviews. Job interviews are notoriously poor. What can interviewers do? First thing you can do is, probably the best way to hire somebody is called a realistic job preview. If I'm going to hire a secretary, I probably would be doing a lot better asking that secretary to get behind a computer and type a letter and see how many mistakes. If I'm looking for somebody in accounts payables, I probably would be better giving them a works sample and asking them to do the work and see how they handle it. If I'm looking for a CFO, probably the best way to hire a CFO is to hire the CFO on an interim basis and say, let's try this out for 2 months to see if it works for both of us. Indeed, for those of you that are in this room that are my clients, you know I say that in mixed company there are certain four-letter words that we do not say in public. And one of the four-letter words that I tell my clients never to say in public is the word J-O-B-S. It's a four-letter word, don't say it. Say you're looking for an opportunity, you're looking for an assignment, you're looking to make a contribution, but for God's sakes, don't say you're looking for a job. Because once you start saying you're looking for a job, the comeback is, oh, how interesting, I'm looking for a job too. I don't know who's hiring, do you? And so you get into this negative cycle. Or I'm looking for a job. Oh, we just had an employment freeze. Sorry about that. Can't help you. So you get into this negative spiral. But in terms of opportunity, assignment, you really want to bring people aboard on an interim basis. to reduce your risks. And as job candidates, you want to go on an interim basis, try it out, because you don't want a hole in your resume. By the way, stop me if you have any questions. Another thing we know about job interviews is the biorhythms and its impact on the labor market. In society, around 2 to 3 p.m., if I was in London, there's something called tea time. How many of you have had tea around 3 p.m.? And in here in Boston, it's called a coffee break. How many have coffee breaks around 2 or 3 p.m.? And if you were in Atlanta, it's called Coca-Cola break. In Purchase, New York, it's called a Pepsi break. But there is a thing around the world that around 2 or 3 p.m., people break off and they have some sort of stimulant. Now the Spanish, who are far more intelligent than we are, they have what's called a siesta. Why is that? Why is it so universal? Well, because our biorhythms tend to have a down during that time. How many of you are old enough to remember Mr. Rogers on television? Does anybody remember what time Mr. Rogers was on television? 7 o'clock. 5, 6, 7 o'clock. Any idea why? Because 5, 6, 7 o'clock are the times when children are wired. 5, 6, 7 o'clock is when we are wired. There are times during the day when your biorhythms are up and down. How many of you can relate to this? You can think about in your own lives when your biorhythms go up and down and up and down. So, if you know your biorhythms, and let's say you schedule an interview for 10 o'clock, which is an up time. You're up, and the person interviewing you is up. It's going to have one flavor. Take the same people and have the same interview at 3 p.m. You're down, and the interviewer is down, and the interviewer is going to say about you, doesn't seem to have a lot of energy. And it wasn't that you didn't have a lot of energy, it was that your biorhythm was down. So again, for those of you who are interviewers, if it's an important interview, you want to schedule the interview at a time when your rhythm is up. Interviewees, you do not have to accept the slot that's given to you when somebody calls and says, can you come in for an interview? If you know that your rhythm is going to be down at 2 p.m., don't say you're busy at 2 p.m., but you could come in at 10 p.m. You can come in at 4 p.m. Schedule the interview at a time when your rhythm is up. Work with your body. Don't work against your body. Another thing. I see this a lot with my clients. You're out of work. You used to go into bed at 10, getting up at 6. Well, at least you don't have to do that anymore, right? So now you can finally watch... You finally watch Jay Leno. And then there was that mystery, that book you've always wanted to read, The Girl with the Golden Tattoo. And so you start reading that, and you know, now it's 1 o'clock. Well, who cares, right? You don't have to get up at any particular time. You get up at 10. Who cares? And so next day, it's Jay Leno, and then you continue reading the book. It's 1 o'clock. You get up at 10 o'clock. Who cares? By the third day, you have now reprogrammed your body. And your body is now off business time and into its own time. Now you're plugging in an interview. When the interviewer may be down, you may be up, or you may be up. In other words, if you're unemployed, stick to the rhythm of business. Don't let your body get out of alignment. Can anybody relate to this? Okay. How many of you have had a telephone screen? Okay. Let's talk a little bit about the telephone screen. One of the trends that has happened, particularly over the last 12 months, is companies are looking to save money, so they're no longer using recruiters as much as they used to. Instead, they are using in-house people from HR to do the search. One of the issues is that recruiters typically know their industry and know the function. The HR person who is doing the internal search may not necessarily understand what you do. I tell my clients to assume that the person who wrote the ad that you're responding to on the internet is 28 years old, went to Bryn Mawr College, majored in English, and really doesn't really have a good feel for the business. Is a good English person, is maybe even a good HR person, but doesn't have a good feel. This morning I was talking with somebody who's in supply chain, and I said, why don't you assume the person who's actually reading the ad, when he or she thinks about supply chain, thinking about something you go to a jewelry store that could be sterling silver or 14 karat gold. They have no idea what a supply chain is. So your letter has to be geared to explaining why there's a fit between what they're looking for and what you have, and don't assume anything. So, for example, this morning, I was talking with a gentleman, and the job we were looking at said, must have SAP. Well, the person doesn't have SAP, but they have XYZ. And in the letter, he didn't say that, you know, since I know I have a black belt in XYZ, I probably could master SAP because it's so similar. You shouldn't assume that the reader understands that. Now, again, this 28-year-old hypothetical person that I'm visioning now went through 150 resumes. And of 150 resumes, now screens it down to 10 to 15 to 20 candidates. And he or she is now calling you for a phone screen. Is it a job interview? No, it's not. It's a screening interview. Because that person's job is to take 20 candidates and narrow it down to 5 to 7 that I actually want to interview. And then out of the 5 to 7, I want to narrow it down further to 3 to 5 that I actually want to introduce to the line manager. So when somebody calls and says, are you available to talk on the phone? Understand it's not a job interview. It's a screening out interview. So here are some suggestions. First of all, when somebody calls you on the phone, you are not required to take the call. You could take the call and the person says, are you available to talk now? And you are perfectly within your rights to say, this is not a good time to talk. Can we reschedule? You may be in the middle of an argument with your spouse. You may be having a problem with your kid. You may just be in a foul mood, or your biorhythm may be down. Whatever. It doesn't matter. You could pick a time that's good for you. So don't, you know, who's in charge? Pick a time when you're going to be up. Second, because it's a phone screen, the person doesn't see you. All they have is the visual cues that they're getting in their ears, and they've got the resume in front of them. Therefore, anything you do or say is going to be overdetermined. By overdetermined, I mean people are going to make more interpretations out of it than the data would warrant. So if I use the word dynamic, powerful, if I use those words several times in the sentence, the person will probably overdetermine that I'm a dynamic, aggressive kind of person. So I want to use that in my favor. So one of the things that I recommend is, how many of you have cordless phones in your house? Okay. So if you're taking one of these calls, do not sit down. Do not sit down. And for God's sakes, do not sit on a couch. You want to be standing up, and you want to be walking around like I'm doing right now. You want to be holding the phone and using your hands. Even though they can't see you using your hands, can you hear the energy in my voice? Just because I'm walking around and using my hands? Again, the person on the other side can't see me, but they can hear the energy. Also, there's more stress on my voice, vocal cords, because I'm walking around. that stress on the vocal cords translates into a feeling that there's energy. Second is, and I can't tell you how many CFOs I was interviewing recently for a CFO job, who totally screwed themselves by saying, what's the salary? I said, well, but the job's pegged at, you know, like 120. Oh, 120, that's kind of on the low side. Well, I'm sorry, that's the way it is. Okay, bam. Hey, you know what? I just eliminated one person. Remember, my job is to screen people out. I'm happy. Now, eventually, I found somebody and said, what's the salary? I said, 120. Ah, great, I'd love to talk with the CEO. The guy got the job, and they negotiated 145. I'm the screener. I'm the recruiter, for God's sakes. I can't negotiate the salary. You want to get through me. You want to get to a decision maker. Once the decision maker falls in love, hey, that's between the two of you. But if you start saying, you know, the salary's not good enough, the title's not good enough, fine, you're giving me all the ammunition I need to screen you out, which is what I was trying to do at the begin with. So thank you very much. So no matter what the job is, no matter how distasteful it is, no matter how low it is, no matter what the title is, I'd like you to say, you know, I wasn't thinking about that, but you never know. I think there's a basis for us to talk. Well, I think there's a basis for us and the CEO or whoever the decision maker is to talk. You want to get through the recruiter to the decision maker. Be positive. Again, because you're on the phone and things are overdetermined, there's certain keywords that you want to use. Words like forceful, aggressive, careful. You can actually look at the job description and look at some of the keywords that were used and replay those words back. Any questions, reactions about this? How does this jive with your own experiences? Michael?
My brother, who had a brief career on the radio, learned a trick from a professional broadcaster who said, "On the radio, Andy, smile,
yes.
Because a smile does come through somehow when you talk."
Michael's saying a smile comes through when you talk. Actually, what happens is when you smile, your vocal cords tense up. And so that creates more tension, excitement. So absolutely, you do want to smile. It looks god-awful stupid, but stand up, move around, and smile while you're talking. Anybody else? Remember, when I call you for a phone interview, remember, my goal is to screen you out. Don't let me do it. You want to get through me. You want to get to the decision maker. You want to tell me, I think there's a basis for us to talk. I think there's a basis for me to meet the hiring authority. Yes?
It's not a phone interview, but somebody called.
Yeah.
This is a recruiter.
Yeah.
Yeah, this position, this is a search firm, not like a Robert Half.
Right.
And says, I'd like to see.
Yes.
How about coming into my office? So now it's not going to be a phone interview, but it's still a screen interview. So person to person, what do you have a suggestion?
So the question is, it's not a phone interview, you're actually going to come into the person's office.
Right.
Okay, so let's...
It's still a screener.
It's still a screener. Okay, let's deal with the person-to-person. And again, if I'm being too basic and insulting, I apologize. We live in a highly networked world. All of you have subscriptions to the internet. I have been shocked And the number of interviews I've had for CFO jobs that I'm recruiting for, where a candidate walks into my office and they have never bothered to look at the company, they've never bothered to look at Stivell Peabody, they've never bothered to look at me. I'm a fairly, you know, if you look under my name, I've got a fairly high profile on the internet. I've written a lot of articles. Will I react in a positive way if somebody is flattering to me? Yes, I am, because I'm human. But more than that, it shows that you're doing your homework. And I've been shocked at the lack of homework that CFOs do when they come in for job interviews. Most recruiters, they're gateway for you. And you just want to get through that gateway. But don't make it that obvious, please. You know, do some homework about the company, about how they're positioning themselves, about the background of the person. How many of you are on LinkedIn? You know, look up that person, the recruiter. You know, is there somebody you know who knows, so that when you walk in, you can say, we don't know each other, but we both know James Smith.
Also, know their competitors.
And know their competitors, absolutely. The other thing that you can do when you walk in for an interview, did you notice the first thing that I did when I came up? I said something self-deprecating about myself. Remember what I said about myself? You know, I said, I've done this, I'm good for this talk, but I'm probably useless for anything else. I was self-deprecating. One of the masters of self-deprecation is, who's that millionaire that everybody likes? Warren Buffett. If you listen to any of Warren Buffett's talks, he is so self-deprecating. He will say, actually, I have a very easy job. I just hire brilliant people and I just stand back. And I don't do very much. Do you believe it? Of course you don't believe it. But the fact that he starts off with a self-deprecating joke makes you feel warm towards him, doesn't it? I wanted you to feel warm towards me, so I started with a self-deprecating joke. Let me give you another example of self-deprecation as a tool. I had a meeting at the Newton Marriott Hotel, 8 o'clock, CEO of a software company. I looked him up. He got his undergraduate degree in economics at Southern Methodist University in Dallas, Texas. And then he came up to Harvard and he got an MBA from Harvard Business School. My goal is to get the sale. I meet him in the lobby and then we head towards the dining room and we sit in the back of the dining room. Now, for those of you, how many of you have traveled the steps from the hallway of the Newton Marriott Hotel to the back of the dining room? How many of you have done that in your careers? Was it 45 seconds walk? Would you say 45 second walk? 30 second walk? It's more than 10 seconds, but it's less than a minute. In that time, I told him the following story. I understand you're from Texas. Yes, I'm from Texas. Well, When I got out of undergraduate school, wanted to go to graduate school, the only school that gave me a scholarship was the University of Texas. But I was so frightened about all these stories about, you know, cowboys with guns and I was just frightened they were going to shoot me. And so I'm a New York City kid, so I got a crew cut. I buy jeans, I buy a cowboy boot, I buy a cowboy shirt with pearls in them. I shaved my beard. I can't get rid of my New York license plate. I was afraid they were going to kill me, so I got a Confederate flag, and I draped it on the back seat of my car, and I roll into Austin, Texas. Now, he's laughing because he and I know that Austin, Texas is like Berkeley, California. So I must—I looked like a really cretin kid coming out the way, dressed the way I was, and he was laughing. That story took about 35 seconds. By the time we sat down, I knew I had made a sale. I had disarmed him by being self-deprecating. Why does this work? The reason it works is that Alex de Tocqueville, way back in 1810 when he wrote about America, he noted something about America which is still true, which is we're mistrustful son of a bitches. We do not trust authority figures. Unlike the Germans, who tend to overtrust authority figures, we mistrust anybody in authority. It doesn't matter if they're Democrats or Republicans. They're all jerks. And anybody who's an authority figure, if they say something positive, like, I sold this, or I achieved this market share, or I did this IPO, do we accept that at face value? No. We apply a discount. You're probably lying. So I'm probably going to discount what you just said. If you use self-deprecation, it works in the other way. Well, I didn't do this. I'm just lucky enough to hire some good people and stand back and let them do the job. Am I going to accept that? No. I'll apply a premium and say, you're probably better than you just said. We Americans do not accept things at face value. How do I know this? There's a wonderful book called Snowball. Anybody ever read Snowball? Okay. You read it. There's a story in Snowball. Now, Warren Buffett was basically a geek, an arrogant geek. He knew one thing, and he knew one thing well, and that was the stock market. But there was a lot of other things that he didn't know, and one of those things he didn't know was interpersonal skills. This guy had absolutely zero interpersonal skills. He goes to Columbia University, and he manages to alienate everybody. And he has this way of acting in a contemptuous way that pisses people off. And then he picks up a book called How to Make Friends and Influence People by Dale Carnegie. How many of you have ever read How to Make Friends and Influence People by Dale Carnegie? If you haven't read it, read it. It's a marvelous book. It is the second most popular book in the United States, second only to the Bible. It was written in 1943. But it is still a valuable book to read. How to Make Friends and Influence People. And basically, Dale Carnegie was recommending certain approaches. Now, Warren Buffett said, I don't believe this. And so Warren Buffett, being a quantitative guy, decides he's going to use the Dale Carnegie approach with 50% of the people that he knows, and then use the normal Warren Buffett style with the other 50% of the people he knows. And then within a month, he decided Dale Carnegie works. After he graduated from Columbia Business School, he moved back to Omaha. He became a teacher of the Dale Carnegie method. Imagine taking a course in Dale Carnegie by Warren Buffett. Basically, every time you watch a Warren Buffett speech or see him on TV, you are listening to a Dale Carnegie speech. He is modeling the Dale Carnegie approach. And one of the things is the self-deprecation. When he puts himself down, you then apply a premium and say, of course he's better than what he says. Anytime a CEO gets an award who says, well, I really don't deserve this, it was my team, you say, ah, what a nice guy. You give him points. So if you're going to make an initial impression, be self-deprecation. Any questions? In terms of research, I have something on our website called Your Business Stethoscopes, and it deals with some of the basic tools, really basic tools, that any job seeker should be using when they're going looking for an opportunity. By basic, I'm talking about things like the RMA studies to look at the ratios of a particular industry. I'm looking at 10-Ks to look at the strategy of a particular company. But if you'd like a copy of the basic business stethoscopes, just write the word stethoscope on a business card and I'll be glad to send it to you. A question that I would tend to ask very early on in the job search is, what's the exit strategy of the business? Again, I've been depressed at how few CFOs ask that straight away. They get into what are the details, what's the next, but they don't ask about the exit strategy. One is, you want to be asking that straight off the bat because it informs the rest of the interview. For example, if the exit strategy is, as you said in your remarks, you know, in 3 years we want to grow the business and sell the business or do an IPO, then that ought to tell you that for the rest of the interview, they're looking for you. Can you move fast? If the issue is a turnaround, the business is doing terrible, we need to either turn around and sell it, turn around and get rid of it, you know, then they're looking for you to be the unemotional business person, make the hard decisions, move on, but don't dwell on it. But you know what? Most businesses in the Boston area are none of those. Most businesses in the Boston area are lifestyle businesses. They are heritage businesses. They're family businesses that have been in the family for two generations and they want it to go on to the third generation. And they're proud of a certain value system that they have. And you're not asking about that. You're not asking about what are the values of this business. Why are you still private? Why are you still a family business? What are the values of the family? When they're looking at you as a non-family member, the question they have is, do you share our values? Or are you just, are you going to be antagonistic towards our values? So that's why I think it's a terribly important question to ask at the beginning, what's the exit strategy? So they'll say it's a turnaround, it's a grow and sell it, or there is no exit. This is what we have been doing for the last 100 years, and God willing, we'll continue to do it for another 100 years. So, and then finally, and this is certainly true for a lot of small businesses, you ask the CEO, what's the exit strategy? And he looks at you funny and he says, huh? I don't know. Well, then your response is, I'm glad you don't know because I can help you think it through. So asking the question, what's the exit strategy, should then set the tone for how are you going to conduct the interview from here on. Any questions? Let me change the remarks to those who are going to be doing job interviewing. As I said before, the research on job interviewing shows that job interviews have a very poor predictive validity. Realistic job previews are the best way to find out if the person will actually do the job. There's a second technique which you can use, and that's called the Argyris technique, A-R-G-Y-R-I-S, named after Chris Argyris of Harvard University. And here's what Argyris said. How many of you remember the 386 computer? Okay. The 386 computer was from IBM. It ran on an MS-DOS platform. It ran on the early Windows platform. It looks like today's computer. Had a hard drive. And it had Microsoft Office. How many of you have used Microsoft Office? Okay, all of you. Had Microsoft Office and a hard drive. So the programs were physically next to each other. But because of the limitations of the memory, when you did something in Microsoft Office, you were just doing something in Microsoft Word. It had no effect on Microsoft outlook. It had no effect on any other office program, right? In order to get into Excel from Word, you had to get out of Word and then go into Excel. You couldn't do both at the same time. Do you remember this? Today's computers are look the same, but they actually talk to each other. But in the 386 version, it didn't. Andres is saying our brains are like this, are like the 386 machine. We have a program in our, right here in our hard drive head. And one of the programs is called, what he calls the espoused theories. This is what I really believe of myself. What I really believe of myself is I'm trustworthy, loyal, kind, brave, thrifty, clean, and reverent. I have an open door policy. I'm respectful of everybody. I believe in diversity. And I'm firm but fair. And if you hook me up to a lie detector, I would pass it because I really do believe in it. Period. The paragraph. If I'm actually in a situation where I actually have to do something, that's a different matter. I have a different program in my head called my theory in use, and that's over here in my brain. So I have to decouple my espoused theory, go into my theory in use, and my theory in use could be totally different than my espoused theory. And like the 386 machine, they don't talk to each other. So not only do I not know that I'm not behaving congruently, it doesn't even register. Which is why everybody seems to be such a hypocrite except you and me, but I'm not so sure about you. It's the way the human brain is designed. So here's what Arturus recommends. Find a case that represents a dilemma. And a dilemma is, there's no easy answer. It could be in any number of different ways. There's no right answer. But a dilemma usually is a choice between two negative outcomes. Heads I lose versus tails I lose. Now, President Obama, what would you like to do? Would you like to stimulate employment? But the cost is going to be, we're going to go further into debt. Or would you like to be known as the president who kept the lid on the debt, but the employment rate continues to go high? What's your choice, Mr. President? What would you like to do? That's a choice between two unacceptable negatives. What would you like to do? Would you like to save American lives by getting out of Afghanistan? Or would you like the Taliban back? Pick. Those are dilemmas, right? American business people are terrific at problem solving. They're crappy about dealing with dilemmas. So if you find a dilemma, a real dilemma, write it up as a case. And then what you do is to say, okay, Kevin, I want you to read this. Now, what would you do, Kevin? Tell me, what would you do? And so Kevin tells me what he does. He says, that's very good, Kevin. So now I want you to actually do it. So I have this tape recorder, and I'm going to turn the tape recorder on, and I'm going to be the protagonist in this drama, and you're going to be talking with me, and you just do what you just said you're going to do. Ready, Kevin? Here we go. Click. As soon as I turn the tape recorder on, Kevin switches from his espoused theory to his theory in use. And it's amazing how little the congruence is and how little Kevin understands that what he did had no relationship to what he said he was going to do. This is exactly what Arduous was talking about. So if you want to increase the validity of hiring, use the Arduous technique. If any of you would like some sample cases that we've used, just put Arduous, A-R-G-Y-R-I-S, on a business card. I'll be glad to send you some sample cases. Any questions about this? Okay. For the rest of the program, I want to answer some questions about the archetype issues, such as, I'm too old. You're not going to be satisfied with the salary. Would you would you be willing to relocate to Timbuktu? Questions like that. But maybe it's time for a seventh inning stretch. Why don't you just get up and just stretch? You've got to be tired sitting down all this time. All right, sit down. That's enough of that. How many of you are concerned about chronological age and that age is a reason why you're not getting the job? How many? Okay, so let's deal with that. Most of my clients have these concerns. So I'm going to tell you what I tell my clients. It's a real issue. But it is also a rationalization why you didn't get the job. Sometimes it is age, but sometimes it's more than that. So let's look at what age means. It's a multi-determined issue. Sometimes age means age. You know, we just want somebody of a certain age group. For example, I've done work at Reebok, and I've looked at the people that they hire at Reebok, and I look at the physical shape that they've got at Reebok, and you know what? I don't qualify physically, and I don't qualify by age. I just don't fit their style. And you know what? When I look at what their business is all about, and what they're trying to sell, and what their strategy is, I wouldn't hire me either. So sometimes it is age, and that's all it is. It's a chronological thing. But sometimes age means something else. Age could also mean energy level. It could be drive. It could be commitment. Al Faber back there is 70 years old.
72.
My apologies. But this guy's got energy more than people half of his age. And he's got drive. But if I looked at Al's resume, or we looked at a picture of Al, I'd say, I'm not sure if he's hungry enough. But he is. How do you convey a sense about that you're hungry? And you know, I have to say, as I look at myself, I don't have the energy that I did when I was 35, and I'm not as hungry as I was when I was 35. So it doesn't work in Al's case, but it works in my case. Bismarck of Germany once said the best offense, the best defense is an offense. And that certainly applies in this case. Discussions about age and anything relating to age, such as disability, health insurance, is illegal in the United States of America. You'd have to be brain dead as an interviewer to raise issues about age with a job candidate. You'd absolutely have to be brain dead. So a job interviewer is not going to deal with this. If they are thinking about age, drive, energy, they're not going to discuss it with you for fear that it's going to trip some sort of age discrimination lawsuit. Therefore, you have to bring it up. In job interviews, I mean, if you get nothing out of this talk, please understand this. The most important questions in the job interview are the questions that are not asked. If you don't raise the issue of age, it doesn't get raised by the job interviewer. If it doesn't get raised, you lost control of it. And it's important that you get control of this issue. So let's talk about how to do that. The phrase is the following. If I were sitting where you're sitting looking at a guy like me, I'd be asking the following question. If I were sitting where you're sitting, looking at a person like me, I would be asking the following question, which basically says, I'm not saying you're doing it, I'm saying if I were sitting where you're sitting. So So we're not going to be dealing with the age discrimination issue. I brought it up. I didn't say you were saying it. I was saying I was saying it, which allows the interviewer to relax and say, well, of course, I wouldn't think that way because it's illegal, but since you brought it up, so that's the phrase. If I were sitting where you're sitting, looking at a person like me, here's what I'd be thinking, blank. So the first issue has to do with energy and drive. Do I have the drive? Do I have the energy? And again, I can't tell you what to say about that, but I've had candidates to say, if I were sitting where you're sitting, looking at a person like me, I'd say, hey, does this person have the drive and energy? Let me assure you, I'm now in my second marriage. I have a child who is 12 years old. And I have the financial needs of a 42-year-old. I am hungry. And the job interviewer relaxed, smiles, and says, that's great. We get the experience of a 60-year-old and the drive of a 45-year-old. That's perfect. If I were sitting where you're sitting, looking at a person like me, I wonder, what about insurance? Suppose he gets sick. Is he healthy enough? Well, my wife works and she's got insurance, so, you know, health insurance is off the table. You don't have to worry about that. I once had a person with clubbed feet, two clubbed feet, and the person wore these special shoes. I don't know if some of you may remember this, the Howdy Doody show. Remember Clarabelle? Anybody remember Clarabelle? Okay, well, Clarabelle was a clown, and he had these big shoes. And this guy had these big, grotesque shoes and would walk into the job interview. And I said, you've got to raise the issue about the shoes and the club feet. And he says, I can't do that. First of all, nobody's ever raised it. Why should I raise it? Just because they're not raising it doesn't mean they're not thinking about it. You've got to raise it. Second of all, when they look at your feet and they see these shoes, you lost control. They're making all sorts of attributions about what does that mean? And you're not in control of this. So he would say the following. He would actually point to his feet and say, look at my feet. Does that remind you of Clarabelle's shoes? And then I would say, yeah, it does. I said, well, it's club feet. Now, let me tell you what I can't do. I can't climb mountains for you. You probably don't want me on your softball team. But short of that, there's nothing I can't do in this job. Fine. The issue was raised. It was discussed. It's over. Here's another one, which is very common. Short job tenure. How many of you have the short job tenure issue in your resumes? Again, it's the same issue. Come on, Michael. You don't short job tenure?
After 15
years. Oh my God. short job tenure is one of those issues where if I'm a job interviewer, I don't know if I want to raise it. It's negative. It sours the meeting. If I've already written you off, maybe I just don't want to deal with it. It's awkward. And I want to make my life easier. So if you've had a series of 1 and 2 year assignments and the interviewer is not questioning you about that, that's not a good sign. You've got to take control. You've got to actually point the person to the resume and say, you'll notice I've had a number of 1 and 2 year assignments. Let me explain. I made a decision to focus on the entrepreneurial world, the transactional world, and in making that decision, there are trade-offs. It's a lot of excitement, a lot of opportunity. I've met some wonderful people, but a lot of the deals that I got involved in didn't pan out. Statistically, that happens. Now, I've actually had candidates who say, and here's what I learned from this assignment. And here's what I learned from that assignment. Here's what I learned from that assignment. And it worked. And she actually got the job pointing out the short job tenure, but focusing on, here's what she learned by in a more positive way. What she had been doing was pointing a finger, you know, and saying, you know, the reason this short was the CEO was a slob, and the reason this didn't work out was, you know, the chairman of the board was a jerk. And this, I said, no, that's not going to work for you. Focus on what did you learn in a positive way. Don't point fingers at other people. Yeah.
Is it safe to say you were a victim of the recession? You know, that actually happened to you.
The words I would use. The question was: is it safe to say that I was a victim of the recession? I might wordsmith it to say, a lot of good people have been affected by this recession, and I consider myself one of them. Any other questions? For those of you, yeah.
What about the question? If you've been in transition for,
yep,
say, 6 or more months,
yep,
what have you been doing? And, you know, there's a tone under that, as in, how come you're still in transition? Or have you decided to take some time off? What have you been doing? So, I know one method to diffuse that is to, as you say, take control at the beginning.
Yep.
And say what you've been doing, networking, improving skills in certain ways, doing consulting,
mm-hmm,
etc. I don't know how you deal with that if you haven't gotten to that point where the question comes up.
It's starting to come up, and I would say, you know, for somebody who's been in a transition 6 months, for me, that's just, at this level, it's just not an issue. When we're looking at over a year, I think it is an issue. You know, you should be doing something. Now, that something doesn't necessarily have to mean you're making a lot of money. If you decide that you're going to be doing some consulting with the active corps of executives with the Smaller Business Administration, I don't even care if you're working at a pizza parlor and helping a person start a pizza parlor for the Small Business Administration. You want to stay in the game. I think the important is, if you've been out of the game for a year, the question is why. You could be in the game. Maybe you can't be making the money you'd like to be making, but there's the MIT startup clinic. There's the Worcester Polytech startup clinic. There's getting involved. Many of the universities have entrepreneur centers where kids are trying to start businesses. Stay in the game. It's about, are you in the game or not? So yeah, I don't know about 6 months. A year? Yeah, I think a year. Why haven't you been doing something? Why aren't you in the game? Any other questions?
Just along the lines of finding a square peg,
yep,
square hole. How do you address that issue going in, that you know that you're not a perfect fit, and there are other candidates just because there's so many people that are out there,
right,
looking for jobs? Do you address that issue head on, and if so, how do you approach that?
If you're not a perfect fit, I'm going to tell you a story. And I think the story relates to what you're saying. I had a client who was a PhD in a very obscure area of biology. And he was interviewing for a job as director of FTC compliance, taking a particular thing through the Food and Drug Administration, FDA compliance, Food and Drug Administration, which for a biotech company is really what it's all about. If you get through the FDA compliance, you're in business. And if you don't get through the FDA compliance, you don't have a business. It's life science is one of those binary things. You're in business or you're not in business. And they were looking for somebody with his technical skills as a biologist and FDA compliance background. And he had been interviewing, several interviews with this large company. And he calls the interviewer for a status report. And the interviewer begins to say, I have been looking for someone with the PhD in your area plus FDA experience, and I can't find that person. And since I have to compromise, and my client knows where this is leading, because he could see the warm-up. He says, wait a second. You're taking a risk if you hire me, aren't you? Well, yes, I am. I'm taking a risk if I hire you. And your risk, if I understand it, is I come aboard, I really don't master the FDA compliance area, and you fire me in two months, and you're going to be looking like a jackass to your boss, and you have to go through this whole search all over again. Yeah, that's right. I hope you realize I'm taking a risk if I take this job, too. What do you mean you're taking a risk if you take this job? Well, it's the middle of a recession. If I took this job, and then 2 months later, I'm back in the job market looking for another job, I've got this hole in my resume. It's not going to look good. I was with this company. How am I going to explain that away? So I'm taking a risk, too, if I take this job. Okay, you're taking a risk if you take the job. Now, since we're both taking risks, I'd like to humbly suggest that I'm taking more risks than you. He said, okay, you're taking more risks than me. I believe I can do a great job for you. And the reason I believe I can do a great job for you is because the risks are too great for me. I wouldn't put myself, I wouldn't put my family in this position if I didn't think I could do a good job for you. And that actually got him calmed down, and he made the job offer to this guy that he was going to turn down. And the guy's been on the job for the last 10 years. Now let's go over that technique. I call it the killer close. Remember I said at the beginning of this talk, the shift has been from find me the best candidate to find me the least risky candidate. It's about the minimization of risk. And in any job interview situation, there is a presumption that we are in a buy-sell relationship. You're trying to sell me something, and I'm not sure I want to buy that. And you're a seller, and I don't trust salesmen. And you feel run down because you feel you're a salesperson too. This technique of you're taking risks, I'm taking risks, and my risks are actually bigger than yours, I wouldn't be asking for this job unless I felt I could do a good job, because we're both taking risks. It says we're not in a buy-sell relationship. We're in the same boat together. If this doesn't work, I suffer too. I'm not trying to pull anything over on you. We both sink. We both swim together. It changes the perception. Let me tell you how I learned this and how I was inspired to do this. How many of you have been to Foreign Motors West in Natick? Okay? So I went to Foreign Motors West. I was in a very difficult time in my life. I had just started Stiebel Peabody Associates. We had just purchased a house in Wayland, and my car died. It was like everything was happening. You know, like sometimes in life, everything happens at the same time. And I need to buy a new car. And I stop in the Foreign Motors West, and I talk to the guy named Dave Thomas. I think he's still at Foreign Motors West. I was actually asking for directions for the Chevy dealership. Because for me to go to Foreign Motors West, given what I had in my bank account, was, you know, it wasn't even on the radar screen. So I just thought I was asking for directions. And so Dave Thomas says, how much do you have to spend? I said, $7,000. You can't get a BMW for $7,000. He said, yes, you can. Come over here. And he shows me a used BMW, which had, again, this was like 1979. It had 60,000 miles on it. And and it was for $7,000. And he says, this will cost you $7,000. It's a great car. So now I'm intrigued. Because I'm not a BMW person. I can't tell one BMW from another BMW. They all look the same to me. So I'm intrigued. Now, how many of you have ever heard of the attraction-repulsion effect from college? Attraction-repulsion effect from Psychology 101 says, the further away you are from a goal, the more attractive it is. The closer you are to the goal, the more repulsive it is. Anybody's ever done a business deal, whether it's a merger or acquisition, or ever gotten married, knows what I'm talking about. The attraction. Further away you are, the more attractive. As you get towards the finish line, it starts getting repulsive, and you don't want to do it. So you need to push somebody over the finish line. So I'm kind of interested in this for $7,000. And Dave Thomas says the following to me. You're taking a risk if you buy this car, aren't you, Larry? I said, you're damn right I am. And your risk, Larry, is you buy this car, you spend $7,000, you drive out of the parking lot, and the thing just collapses on you. And you're out $7,000 and you got a piece of shit. I said, that's right. I'm taking a risk if I sell you this car. What do you mean you're taking a risk if you sell me this car? Larry, what kind of commission do you think I make on this car? I don't know. He says, 10%. I sell you this car, I'm going to make $700. I said, so? I said, Larry, you write a column for the Boston Business Journal, which I did at the time. He says, you live in Wayland. I don't get a lot of business of people coming in looking for Chevy dealerships. I do business in Wayland and Weston and Wellesley through referrals. Suppose I'm able to sell you this car and it's going to be a crap car for you and you're going to be unhappy. Aren't you going to be telling all your friends that Dave Thomas sold you a piece of crap? I said, yeah, I will. And maybe because you write a column in the Boston Business Journal, you might even write a column about the garbage that you were sold at Foreign Motors West. Don't you think my reputation is worth more than $700 to me? I said, yeah, that makes sense. Larry, even if you wanted this car, I wouldn't sell you the car unless I thought this is going to work for you. Because my reputation is worth more than $700. We're in the same boat. And I go, yeah, we're in the same boat. I buy the car. I drove it to about 140,000 miles. And then I traded it in, and I think I got like $4,000 trade in value. I mean, it was a great experience. And I always tell the story, and I always talk about Foreign Motors West and Dave Thomas to give him his due. He taught me this technique. And it's called the killer close. So again, let's go over the killer close. The killer close is as follows. You're taking a risk if you hire me. And here's the risk. A, B, C, D. Am I right? Yes. I'm taking a risk if I join your company. Here's my risk. A, B, C, D. I wouldn't take this job unless I thought I could do a great job because the risks are too high for me and my family. If you could say, now, this only works if it's you really believe it to be true. It can't be a gimmick. You really have to believe it for it to work. But again, the beauty of this is it transforms the nature of the employment interview from a buy-sell relationship to a we're-in-the-same-boat relationship. So that's why I call it the killer close. Any questions? Okay, I will close with one last issue, and that's the management of fear. And what have we learned in the last 25 years about the management of fear? There's a wonderful book out that I can recommend to you. Unfortunately, I can't pronounce the guy's name. His name is Pillory, P-I-L-L-A-R-Y, Srivastsan Pillory. He's a psychiatrist at McLean Hospital at Harvard University. And he wrote a book called Life Unlocked. Life Unlocked. And it basically is a sort of layman's guide to some of the things that we are learning about neuroscience. And I just described it because I think it's pretty exciting. You see these squirrels scurrying about? You see the number of squirrels that you're running over on cars that aren't on a roadway? So what happens is, when the fall comes, the poor little squirrel has this really primitive brain, and it's got a little thing called the amygdala. And the amygdala regulates emotions, joy, happiness, sexual arousal, all that stuff that goes to the amygdala. But the amygdala is programmed, above all, with fear. Fear is the primary trigger for the amygdala. And then that poor little squirrel, when the light starts going, when something happens and it's fall, the squirrel's amygdala says, danger, 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 fear, 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 and starts scurrying all around for those nuts. And it risks its life to go across the road, and you see the results. Now, that poor squirrel doesn't have much of a cerebral cortex to regulate the amygdala. So we move towards the further stage of evolution, and that's us. We have a cerebral cortex over the amygdala. But that's equivalent to what's going on in my house today. I'm painting my house. I'm having my house painted. Now, if I'm having my house painted, does that mean I'm having new paint applied? Yes, I'm having new paint applied over old paint. Does that mean the old paint disappears? No, the old paint is still there. And it's going to affect the coloration of the new paint. And eventually the old paint will seep in to the new paint, right? And what happens with our brains and our evolution is just because we have a cerebral cortex doesn't mean the amygdala is not working. The amygdala is working. It's like the old paint under the new paint. It's still in play. Now, here's an example. The new thing is the MRI, magnetic resonance imaging, and the studies of the brain through MRI. They'll put somebody in an MRI machine, have them lie down, they got the brain wired, and they're watching slides. They're showing slides, and every once in a while they will show pictures of fear, usually a woman or a man who looks horribly afraid. And they're looking at what point does the amygdala recognize fear, and at what point does the cortex recognize fear. 10 milliseconds is 1/100th of a second. 1/100th of a second exposure, the amygdala recognizes fear. Can you think about how fast 1/100th of a second is? If you were looking at pictures at 1/100th of a second, you couldn't see it. It would just look like a blur to you. By 100 milliseconds, that's 1/10th of a second, the cortex kind of says, something's going on here, but I don't know what it is. And by 400 milliseconds, the cortex is fully, it's got it. It sees that something is wrong. So think about that. The amygdala reacts before the cortex understands what's going on. So you've got a separate sensory section. Freud was absolutely right. There is such a thing called the unconscious. Things are going on without our awareness. There's nothing magic about it. Our heart, we breathe without our awareness. Our heart rhythm is over our awareness. But our emotions also are triggered by the amygdala without our awareness. So what happens is, because fear is so powerful with the amygdala, if you're in a job, if you're in a transition mode, the amygdala is pumping out these fear vibrations. You'll always be unemployed. You'll never get work. This is the way you're going to end up. The amygdala is programmed to do it. And the point of the book is you cannot stop the amygdala. Pillory describes the amygdala as the tuba in the orchestra of life. So just as the tuba is in the orchestra, it's playing its tuba thing. It's going to play its tuba thing. You cannot stop it from playing its tuba thing. Your only option is the more you pay attention to the tuba, the more you lose. The more you decide you're consciously going to pay attention to piccolo at the expense of the tuba, the more you can manage it, but you can't control it. There's a final comment that I love. There's a guy named Jim Hollingsworth, who was a writer, and he was a manager of a rock band called Quicksilver, which was out in San Francisco. And he said, courage is not the absence of fear. It's a judgment that there's something more important than fear. So the point of the book is, if you're fearful, it's okay to be fearful. And don't try to stop the fear. But try to manage the fear and work with the fear and pay attention to other things. Thank you very much. And again, if any of you would like copies of anything we talked about or the MP3 of this talk, just write it down on the business card. I'll be glad to send it to you.
Thank you.
This one's fine, I guess.
Yeah.
Now I got two.
Well, this one will work.
All right.
I'll take that.
Of course, I don't know how to use this one.
It works.
So thank you very much, Larry. I apologize. We usually have gifts for our presenters, but Paul being out of town and me being socially inept, we don't have a gift.